Welcome, everybody. This is the third week office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Anarcho-Capitalism. This is an expanded version of an earlier course we did, I think, 2 years ago. It's August 18th, 2012 today, and we last week did the lecture on private defense and actually got into some things that I've never talked about before. So that's what happens with these things. You start going, making connections, maybe giving examples of things, spelling out implications that are on the fly. So I actually have asked Danny Sanchez to, well, he's not going to be the one to do it. Chad, the audiovisual guy at the Mises Institute, is going to make what you guys heard of as Lecture 3 available. We're going to give that to the masses, because partly to serve as a commercial for Mises Academy to say, hey, if you've never taken a class, this is the kind of stuff we do here, but also because I think I hit some points that are fairly novel, and so I wanted to get that out there so that all the young budding anarchists have that in their bag of tricks. Okay, great. George Smith has a question. Austrian economics is based on the axiom that humans act, but is that really the ultimate epistemological foundation? Since the action referred to is purposeful, doesn't that presuppose a mind capable of setting a purpose? If so, shouldn't economics be based on the fact that humans think rather than the observation that they act purposefully? Hang on a second. Let me think about that while I drink some coffee. Well, let me make some true statements, George, and then I don't know if this is going to answer your question. You can certainly push back if you're not satisfied, especially since no one else has typed in a question yet. So you're right. Austrian economics in the Misesian praxeological tradition starts with what's called the action axiom that says people act. And for a lot of newcomers, they're thinking, what the heck is the deal with that? I mean, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? And so one thing to say is, well, yeah, we didn't want to start with and base our whole viewpoint on something that was controversial. But it does, it's not saying people behave. And I realize, George, you know this, but I just want to make sure people who are new to this stuff understand what we're even talking about. That action, in the way that Ludwig von Mises uses the term and his followers, means purposeful behavior. So it means there is a mind at work that is trying to achieve an end with that behavior. So when I'm teaching this stuff, I'll use examples to distinguish the two and say, if I'm walking outside and all of a sudden a car behind me backfires, you know, boom, and I go like this, it's not clear whether that's an action or not. It could just be reflexive behavior. It's not, you know, it wasn't that I necessarily was trying to do anything by flinching. It could just be a natural bodily reaction that my nervous system did. And you can come up with some evolutionary story about why that's in me, but that's a far different thing from if I'm talking to somebody and they're looking over my shoulder and they say, whoa, Bob, duck. And then I duck. There was some conscious thought involved, albeit very quickly. There I had to process what the person was saying. I had to judge from their expression, like were they just playing a joke, or, you know, if they're talking and they go, Bob, duck, you know, then I can tell they really think something's coming up behind me that I need to duck. And so there it's the same movement of my body, but yet we interpret it differently as analysts looking at this scene, because in the first case, there really wasn't, you know, my willpower wasn't involved, or my ego, if you want to use some kind of psychological terminology, whereas in the second case, even though it happened pretty fast, and you might argue, oh, well, you didn't really think about what you were doing. Well, in a sense, I did, though. And we can, of course, make things that are even more obvious, like the doctor hitting my knee with the hammer and my leg going up versus someone saying, hey, I'll pay you $5 if you lift your leg up. And I say, okay, and I lift my leg out to get the $5. Clearly, the one thing there, that bodily movement of my leg going up is a reflex, not something I thought about. I wasn't trying to achieve anything by doing that. In the second case, clearly it's purposeful behavior. It's action in a Mosesian sense. I was trying to do something. You know, someone says, what was Bob hoping to achieve by lifting his leg? And I said, well, for some reason, that guy was going to give him $5, so he did it for the $5. Okay, so now what George is asking is, why are we founding Austrian economics, or more accurately, praxeology? Because in theory, you could be a believer in Austrian economics and not like the Mosesian approach on this stuff. Why are we founding praxeology in the Mosesian tradition on this so-called action axiom? Because that already presupposes a mind, so shouldn't we push it back and say it's based on thought? I don't know what others would say, George, but I think it has to do with the fact that what Mises was trying to isolate was not so much what's going on with the object of our study, but he was trying to show the study itself, the discipline of praxeology, is the study of action, meaning we're studying that subset of human activity that we as analysts or observers interpret by ascribing purpose or intention to it. So because, you know, Mises, what he was trying to do is he was trying to say, okay, I'm an economist. He was obviously trained in economics. He had written a lot of stuff in economics, and he was trying to be real philosophical, big picture, to take a step back and say, all right, what is the common element in everything I'm doing? It's not just that I'm talking about people dealing with money. No, what I'm talking about is broader than that. What is it? Is it just talking about people working and trading stuff? Well, no, that's not quite it either. And he was trying to figure out what's the boundary of this discipline. What is it that I do in my day-to-day life or job when I'm doing economics? And then that's when he, you know, so he had catalactics that was the science of exchanges, and that would be economics proper. But then he said, but, you know, there's something even broader than that. And so the next boundary line that he drew was to say, when humans engage in purposeful behavior and they use means to achieve ends, that's really what we're studying, of which if trading is involved in some way, then, and it could be trading with nature, then that's what we call economics proper or catalactics, but the broader thing is praxeology. So I think that's why he did it that way, George, because if he went your route and said, well, let's push it back one step further and not look at the outward manifestation of these thoughts, but let's start with the thinking per se, well, that wouldn't be enough. We actually don't know. We can't talk about other people's thoughts except insofar as we can see them illustrated through their actions. So I'm guessing that's what Mises or Rothbard would say to you, or you can ask Hans Hoppe what he thinks, or David Gordon, or Guido Holtzman, and my guess is they would say something along those lines, that we ultimately, this is not actually, in Austrian economics, or in praxeology, we don't actually get inside the heads of other people. What we do is we look at their actions and then start making true statements about it. So when I see somebody trade an apple for an orange, And then I say, oh, I as an economist explain that by saying, I think it was a purposeful behavior. I don't think it was just he tripped and the apple fell out of his hand and then he was falling and grabbed the orange. But no, I think he meant to actually trade those things. He understood that he was giving up possession of the apple and gaining the orange or whatever I said. And so now how do I explain that as an economist? I could say, well, I think he has this scale of preferences and he must have valued the orange more highly than the apple. But see there, it's I'm starting with the observation of what he did. And I'm saying the best way for me to make sense of that is to assume that there is this mental value scale involved. Right, so I think that's why they start with action, because it would be a little bit loosey-goosey to start with thought. Because you're right, action does presuppose thought, and that's fine. So thought is in there. So if you want to say praxeology at the very outset assumes that there are other thinking beings out there, that's fine. But the unit of analysis is us observing action. So we can't observe thought directly is what I'm getting at. So I don't know if that is helping you, but I believe that was what Mises and Rothbard would say. Okay, any other questions? Remember, it's better to ask me something silly than to do nothing at all, because otherwise we just sit here and then I have to decide if I should just start making up stuff to answer. Okay, well, okay, great. Tate says, what do you think of David Friedman's assertion in The Machinery of Freedom that local defense organizations, quote, must be, permanently endowed for the purpose of providing defense? They cannot be simply local firms with an interest in the protection of their territory, since such firms, having agreed to pay part of the cost of national defense, would be driven out of business by new competitors who had not. Such an insurance company, in order to pay the cost of defense, would have to charge rates substantially higher than the real risk justified given the existence of its defense system. Unfortunately, Tate, it's been a few years since I've read Machinery of Freedom. So I vaguely remember that part of the book you're talking about, and I remember that I didn't think he was right, but it's going to be hard for me off the top of my head to pinpoint exactly what he said that was wrong and what the answer is. So I'll try to do it, but it's possible I'm going to be unfair to him because I'm not reproducing exactly what his point is, if that makes sense. So I'll set up some possible objection and knock that one down, but it's possible that what I'm saying isn't quite hitting what Friedman's getting at here. So the problem with the free rider problem or the public goods problem, and they're very related, is that when it comes to insurance companies providing defense, and I touched on this in the lecture, that okay, so if there's no insurance companies, if you're just paying, if homeowners and just individual people, individual firms, you own a grocery store, and you obviously don't want foreign bombers to blow it up, that kind of stuff. So there are people, there's clearly a market for defense services because people don't like to get blown up and pillaged and conquered. So even with no state, clearly people are going to be willing to pay money to some firm that gives them an expectation that they will reduce their likelihood of being attacked by a foreign army. So why is it that in the standard academic literature, the economics literature, and then this has been adopted by other social scientists when they try to talk about this stuff, because they think that this is standard stuff in economics. Why is military defense something that the free market allegedly does a very poor job of providing? So why is this a classic service that ought to be handled by the government? Because the problem is, or the alleged problem, is that by its very nature, defense from foreign aggression has aspects of a public good, and it's susceptible to what's called the free rider problem, so that if enough of my neighbors are paying some company to protect their houses from foreign bombers, chances are, technologically speaking, whatever it is they're doing so that my neighbors' houses are protected, my house is probably not protected too. As opposed to, you know, there's no free rider public good problem when it comes to pizza delivery. If my neighbor pays Pizza Hut to make a pizza and drive it to their house, it's not like I get to eat the pizza too. And so that's why a free market in pizza is fine. There is no public good problem or externalities or free riders. But the claim is with military defense, it's not like that at all. If a private company is doing things to protect certain paying customers, chances are a lot of non-paying customers are going to benefit also. They're going to be able to free ride. So given that that's the incentive structure, the idea is that there's going to be way too little production of military defense in a free market. That if you figured out what's the optimal amount of resources going into military defense versus going into pizza production, going into shoes, going into automobiles and so on, the claim is there's going to be too little resources going into there. That on the margin, if some resources got sucked out of pizza and movies and fancy automobiles and got redirected into providing more military defense, that would cause more marginal benefits than the marginal cost. Or another way of putting it is, redirecting some of those resources, people would lose out on that last pizza, that last theater that could have opened that would show movies, that last restaurant that could have opened, and they would gain from there being more tanks and bombers and whatever to repel foreign invaders. And if you somehow aggregated that, you would find they would gain on net, that they would prefer to have those extra tanks and bombers and radar and whatever, and to have fewer pizza places and fewer movie theaters and whatever. But the market won't produce that, is the claim, just because of the odd nature of military defense. So the one way to get around that, it seems, is to bring up the fact that, well, maybe people aren't directly paying the tank company. They're not directly paying the company that builds bombers. They're not directly paying the company that has SAM sites, surface-to-air missiles, that protect your house from incoming enemy bombers. Maybe they pay premiums to an insurance company that then provides these services. So that would possibly, especially if there's a big, so everybody would want to get that kind of insurance. And then it seems like, oh, so that would work, and this is what I talked about in the lecture, that everyone wants to get that kind of service because, or insurance, because nobody wants to be left out high and dry in case there is an attack. But the point is now we've just pushed the problem back one step, because now you say, okay, with this insurance market, it's expensive to maintain bombers and things like that. So why wouldn't – so if one company is the first one on the scene and everybody in the community signs up and gives them whatever – $10,000 a year for military insurance, and then they use those premiums to maintain the fleet of tanks and snipers and blah, 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 why wouldn't some competitor insurance agency come along and say, okay, since they have now built up all those that armament and all these troops and everything, trained all these snipers, we'll make the same pledge, you know, we'll make the same property rights redemption and so forth, coverage, is the word I was looking for, and we'll charge, instead of charging $10,000 a year, we'll just charge $2,000 a year, because the probability of such losses for our customers are basically the same as for their customers, and so we'll free ride on them. So there, so the point, the claim is the Rothbardian approach of having insurance companies be the ones that are directly paying the military contractors as opposed to the average household. The claim is we haven't solved the free rider or the public goods problem. We've just pushed it back one step. We've just transferred it from the individual households now to the insurance providers. Okay, so what is my, and it sounds like from that quote you put in there, Tate, my vague recollection of what Friedman's doing in Machinery of Friedman, it sounds like he's getting at that kind of issue. So I have a few responses, some of which I already gave in the lecture, and I think I pointed out all of them in chaos theory, but I'll just recapitulate them. So the first thing is to say, even if it were true that all we did by switching to the insurance model is to transfer the free rider or the public goods problem from all the millions of households and concentrated into the insurance sector, well, that right there would be progress, because with the type of reasoning that you, that we commonly associate with the phrase the Coase theorem, with that sort of argument, we realize if transaction costs are low enough and people can have contracts in all sorts of odd things and have really refined contracts and so forth, and they're enforceable, then you can't have inefficiency in the neoclassical sense. All right? It can't be the case that the equilibrium outcome is an underprovision of services in some sector and an overprovision in other sectors because of a free rider problem or whatever. That can't happen so long as there are well-defined property rights and transaction costs for making contractual arrangements dealing with those property rights are low enough, because people would just write contracts and things that got around these prima facie problems or stumbling blocks. And so, like I say, forget the insurance companies. What you could do if you were, so right now we have an anarchist society, we're all sitting ducks. The foreigners are coming at us. They've got a bunch of tanks. They've got a bunch of troops who are getting ready to rape and pillage. Oh, my gosh, that's an awful thing that's about to happen. But if we have the technological ability, if only we could get everybody in the community to give 10% of their income, we could easily produce an army and tanks and blah, blah, blah that would repel those invaders. They wouldn't even get across our border. But because we're in a voluntary society, we don't have a state that can compel everyone, that can't tax us all 10%. Oh, man, we can't do that. Too bad. We're all sitting ducks. Well, one way to solve that using the logic of the Coase theorem would be some company would say, all right, we're going to have a conditional contract. We're going to go to everybody and say, the contract does not say you pay us a certain amount of money and then we protect you. The contract also doesn't say you give us a certain amount of money and then we're going to field an army and go use it to attack guys. So it's not like we're just raising donations for this good cause of beating the aggressors, because that also would be plagued by the public good problem. What the contract says is you pledge 10% of your income. And if and only if 95% of your neighbors also sign the contract, does it. But if only 94% of your neighbors sign the contract, then it does not kick in. No one gets charged, and we sit here and get destroyed by the invaders. So if you run through the logic of that, you as the individual household, it's in your interest. It's part of the Nash equilibrium, if that's the language you want to use, for you to sign that. Because in the case where, so if you're not on the borderline, well, if it's 100%, put it that way. If it's 100% of your neighbors need to do it, then it's in the Nash equilibrium for you to sign that thing. I don't want to on the fly worry about 95%, because maybe then it wouldn't be. But if it's a, you know, all or nothing, every single person in society has to sign this thing or else it's null and void, then nobody loses from signing it, right? In the scenario where you sign it and some of your neighbors don't sign it, well, it doesn't hurt you to sign it. You're not out any money, right? So whether you sign it or not, same thing to you. And in this, the one scenario where your signature makes a difference is where everybody else has already signed it or is going to sign it, and then your decision to sign would mean 100% the contract kicks in, and if you don't, that means the contract doesn't kick in. So then at that point, the issue is, are you willing to give up 10% of your money to make the difference between your whole society getting overrun by foreign invaders or not? And clearly everyone is going to say, oh, sure, I'll pay 10% of my money for that if my 10% is making the difference. And you can't give 8%. That's the thing. The contract has got to be 10. Okay, so you get what I'm saying. If you could structure the contracts like that, then it would work. And that would be a Nash equilibrium. So the, you know, even people just being completely selfish, individually rational, there's no need for public spiritedness at all in terms of how much private benefit do I get from giving up my money to this defense agency. It's totally fine. It's supportable in equilibrium. But the problem is that's kind of difficult to imagine a society with hundreds of millions of people, a firm that's going to have a contract that's that conditional and that you need to get 100% of the people to sign up on. Okay, so the way around that is you can have agreements with the insurance companies now. It's easier. And so what they would do, it's more logical to assume they're going to come up with agreements among each other or big property owners, right? So you really don't need to have 200 million people all agreeing on this thing. To defend the current geographical borders of the United States, you don't need everyone to be kicking in. If just the major property, if all the millionaires or up agreed among themselves, okay, guys, come on, let's not be stupid here. We don't want to get invaded by foreigners. We got to come up with some way around this free rider problem. They could do it. Even if just all the billionaires in the United States talk with each other, they could come up with something that would work. So that's what I'm getting at. So part of my answer is, because the free market would be so much more effective than state-provided militaries, we have a huge margin for error. We don't really need to have the Pareto optimal outcome in terms of some textbook economic theory. You would have a basic, feasible, highly effective military defense funded through purely voluntary means through some of these mechanisms that I'm talking about. And I don't know in practice which one would prevail, but the point is the free society wouldn't just sit there twiddling their thumbs and think, oh man, the free rider problem, we're screwed, and get taken over. That's not what would happen. Somebody would figure out a way to get around that. As far as the insurance companies and David Friedman's scenario, maybe one way they would do it is they would have contracts of a certain minimum length. And so maybe that's kind of what he's getting at, that the insurance companies that provide military defense might say to their new clients, we're not going to give you one-year renewable policies. If you're signing up with us, you are agreeing that you're going to pay us premiums, you know, unless you can show financial hardship or something, for the next 15 years. Or maybe they'll say, you got to put up this big bond up front, and if you cancel early, then you forfeit the bond to us, or something like that. So, I mean, they would want to structure it so that when they get people in, they have a long stream of income, and that they're not susceptible to some newcomer entering the industry and then losing all their customers to that guy. So maybe that's one way it would happen. But again, like I say, I think it really wouldn't take all that much for the free society to adequately defend itself from state militaries. And so we don't have to figure out some way that we can extract 10% of everybody's income. It wouldn't need to be that much. Just like I said, just the billionaires. I mean, you could defend the current United States right now easily by spending $1 billion a year. So it's not like we have to come up with something to match the current Department of Defense budget. There's no way that they wouldn't have to spend that much. Not at all. Okay. Tate says, do you think Paul Krugman generally makes criticisms of the Austrian school in good faith or is disingenuous? How would you respond to his claim that Austrians have been horribly wrong about inflation? This one's tricky. Let me say this. Krugman's criticisms of the Austrian school are unfair in the sense that he's not at all even understanding what the Austrian position really is. And the classic example of this is the one time when he responded to me in print and went through and went through my so-called sushi story. Among the criticisms he leveled is that Krugman said something like, and how do the Austrians explain the fact that the empirical literature shows central banks really do affect the timing of the business cycle? And if you just think about it, that's an astounding thing for him to say. He's actually saying to the Austrians, how can you Austrians be right about business cycles? Because clearly from the academic research and just studying them empirically, we mainstream economists know that central banks have something to do with the boom-bust cycle. So how can you Austrians be right? I mean, that would be like me saying to him, Krugman, how can your theories about recessions be right? Because we know that by running budget deficits, governments can pull economies out of recession. So how could you possibly be right? I mean, that's how stupid that objection is. It would have to be the opposite. If the empirical literature showed the central bank had no effect on the timing of the business cycle, then Krugman could bring that up as an objection to the Austrian approach. So that just shows how clueless he was about what the Austrian view is that he would say that. Now, to understand what did he mean, so I think, Tate, you're getting at if Krugman a lot of times throws objections out of the Austrian that don't even make any sense, does he realize they don't make sense? And is he just thinking, but so what, my fans are idiots, or not idiots, my fans are ignorant of the Austrian school, so I'll just discredit them and no one's going to know. Yeah, the Austrians are going to know that I'm totally setting up a straw man, but who cares? My point here isn't to be fair. My point is to beat them publicly. If that's what you're thinking, I don't believe Krugman is consciously doing that. I think Krugman believes he's blowing people up and he doesn't need to cheat because in his mind he's right. So I don't think Krugman believes he's consciously lying. So, for example, on that particular point that I just mentioned, I think what Krugman had in mind is he thought the Austrians are a variant of what's called real business cycle theory, which tends to be associated with free market economists who talk about the fact that people are real rational, and in those real business cycle models, the government and the Fed don't have much power to do anything. And in particular, in a real business cycle model, a recession is caused because of real factors. Like there's a productivity shock or a resource shock or something like that, and that's why there's a recession. So it's like the economy is rationally responding to the new information, and so there really does have to be a recession in order for things to get readjusted. And in that kind of framework, the government coming in and trying to mess with things just doesn't do any good. So you can see why that kind of story superficially sounds exactly like what the Austrians are saying. And so that's why I think Krugman, because what Krugman's objection is applicable to the real business cycle guys. So it would make sense for Krugman to throw that in their face and say, you guys are nuts, because clearly it looks like central banks can influence recessions or the boom-bust cycle, so you guys are nuts for thinking this is purely a market response to underlying real conditions of supply and demand and scarcity and stuff. That no, this is a monetary phenomenon. This has to do with nominal rigidities, blah, 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 like we Keynesians have been saying. So that's where he's coming from. But like I say, he doesn't really know exactly what the Austrian position is. And he just assumed it was kind of like the real business cycle school, which he is familiar with because that's taught in grad school. Like Krugman has learned those models, whereas he obviously didn't really get hit deep into his study of Austrian economics. The other part of your question, Tate, how would you respond to his claim that Austrians had been horribly wrong about inflation? I'm not sure, because I personally, and I mean, I'm one of the Austrians that has been horribly wrong about inflation. Because I have publicly, I mean, not so much in articles at Mises.org, because I wasn't that reckless, but on my personal blog since the crisis really kicked in and then the Bernanke started doing all his stuff, I have been warning about the consequences of this monetary inflation and saying, among other things, you're going to see a weakening of the dollar and rising consumer prices, and that Americans need to get ready for having the purchasing power of their nominal paychecks and whatever savings they have to, for that to get crushed because of what Bernanke's been doing. So people were pressing me and saying, okay, Bob, but don't just throw out these vague doomsday scenarios. Be more specific. When is this coming? Are you saying at some point in the next 50 years or what? And so in order to not just have these vague, dire warnings, I was giving specific targets and saying, well, I think even official CPI, even though we know the BLS tinkers with those numbers and tries to downplay and all that stuff, I think just they're not going to be able to hide it, that they're going to have to report year-over-year CPI inflation of such and such by this time. And I, at least two of my predictions have already been wrong. And right now I have pending wagers with Brian Kaplan and David Henderson, two of the guys that blog at EconLog, and the one with David Henderson, I'm almost sure I'm going to lose because I think I have to have like 10% year-over-year CPI inflation like by the end of this calendar year, I think. So that doesn't look like it's going to happen unless there's some major international event in the next few months and the dollar crashes overnight. Looks like I'm losing that bet. And then my one with Brian, I have more leeway for it to happen, but right now he's probably feeling pretty comfortable about his position on that wager. So the question then, and people have been throwing that in my face and saying, so Bob, you know, are you totally wrong about this stuff or what's your deal? And I'm not sure, because I still think my underlying understanding of how the economy works and my view that the problem in 2008 was not that we didn't have enough fiat money. And so if that wasn't the issue, why would just creating a bunch more fiat money fix things? To me, that doesn't make any sense. So at best, that just would have postponed the inevitable and made the subsequent crash that much worse. So I still think that, but yet I'm not as confident now as I would have been 2 years ago, because I would have thought more people would have seen it by now. So it's sort of like, if somebody in the year 2005 is running around saying, oh my gosh, there's a housing bubble, these prices are way too high, there's going to be a crash, and people are saying, you're an idiot. And then a year goes by. Now it's 2006, prices are even higher. And everyone's like, I remember you idiot last year when you said there was a housing bubble. What do you say now? Well, presumably the person could have said, well, there still is a housing bubble. Now the crash is going to even be worse than it would have been last year. And I can't believe how stupid these investors are, but crash is still coming. But if year went by and it gets to be 2020 and housing keeps going up and up and up, at some point you might think, wait a minute, am I doing something wrong here? So that's kind of the position I'm in. I still, if there's a big fall in the dollar and then CPI starts rising at double-digit rates for a few years, I'm going to say, okay, yeah, I was just a little off on the timing. But I thought it would have started to manifest itself already at this point. And so I am just pulling back and saying I'm not sure exactly what's going on. I would say one other thing, though, for sure we can say about Krugman is he is being completely disingenuous when he keeps running victory laps and making it sound like he totally called all this. All right, he has been warning about outright deflation. He had no clue about gold prices. For a while, I mean, at one point, he even said, he explained surging gold prices by saying it was because of Glenn Beck freaking everybody out, and so that's what caused the bubble in gold. Right? I mean, he didn't say the word bubble. Okay? I mean, that's just stupid. And that's clearly him just making up stuff ex post. And then finally he settled on some rival theory that said, oh, well, I can explain gold prices because it's a change in the real cost of holding a commodity versus being invested in bonds and all that kind of stuff. So he now explains gold as being a fall in real interest rates. But that wasn't his explanation in the beginning. In the beginning, he didn't think gold was going to go up. So he just thought there was going to be a general fall in prices, or at least a general disinflation. And so surging commodity prices didn't fit into his model at all. And like I said, I'm not putting words in his mouth. He literally at one point said the reason gold is so high is because of Glenn Beck and all these people on Fox News and talk radio freaking everybody out. And so if you run the numbers, if all these conservative right-wingers who listen to Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck went out and bought an ounce of gold, well, that would explain what happened. I mean, that's what he was doing. So he clearly didn't see that. So for Krugman now to make it sound like he's just called every twist and turn since 2008 is disingenuous. And I don't know if he realizes how disingenuous he's being or not, but clearly that's not accurate. So he is right that people like me, probably people like Peter Schiff, have said things since 2008 where we implied or literally gave a time frame and we were wrong. And so at this point, for me, the question is just, okay, did we call a little bit early or is our framework really screwed up? And I don't know. What I would say is, because people ask me, okay, well, then how do you know, Bob? What's your time frame for admitting you screwed up? Well, let me put it this way. If the U.S. emerged out of this, if unemployment went back down to whatever, 5%, and the excess reserves in the commercial banks went back down to normal levels, and then it looked like we were back in a normal economy, and we went several years like that, and then maybe had a recession that was just a normal kind of recession, and it really looked like we got out of this with no ill effects except for this intermediate period of a really bad economy with no massive price inflation at any point, then I would agree, okay, yeah, I misdiagnosed what happened there. But right now, the stuff Bernanke did that was freaking me out is still hanging over our heads. There still is a trillion plus in excess reserves in the commercial banking sector, and the Fed cannot just erase that without totally destroying the financial sector. So it's the stuff we were warning about is still potentially going to happen. It's just I'm surprised at how big a margin the world investors have given to Bernanke and Geithner. And it's possible it's the situation in Europe that did that, that maybe since the crisis has struck Europe first, people have given a pass to the United States, and that once Europe resolves itself one way or the other, all of a sudden it'll look like the contagion spreads to the U.S. and all of a sudden we'll look like geniuses. Who knows? Okay. Donald Koss says, anarchist societies and nuclear weapons. The arguments in chaos theory seem weak. A nuclear state may see the anarchist society as non-threatening, but an aggressive state may opt to use nuclear weapons for conquest, either directly, and then in parentheses, nuclear attack, or indirectly, nuclear blackmail. It seems that an anarchist society may need to acquire nuclear weapons just to counter that threat. To assume being non-nuclear is safe seems presumptuous. Would you reconsider your argument about a non-nuclear stance? I guess we have to be more specific. Which governments are you talking about, and where is this anarchist society? I mean, if it's some floating platforms in the middle of the Pacific and they do a bunch of financial transactions, and that's why, and there's 100,000 people who live on these floating platforms and they're fantastically wealthy, and some third world dictator isn't going to be able to touch them because he's not going to be able to deliver a nuclear bomb to them, missile. And if And if they could, they're going to be just relatively, I mean, it's only going to be a few. And so you wouldn't need to have a nuclear weapon yourself. You would just need to have, like, satellite-based lasers or sophisticated surface-to-air missiles, conventional missiles that would take the thing out in flight or whatever. So, I mean, that's, and if you're talking about, well, no, it wouldn't be some podunk little dictator. I'm talking about, like, the United States or Great Britain. Well, then there, what I said in the lecture, I think, is true. I don't think the United States government could just go out and nuke somebody just right off the bat. I think they would first have to start waging conventional warfare, and as long as if the anarchist society reacted in the ways that I think it naturally would, I don't think the U.S. government could literally drop a bomb on them, a nuclear bomb, just like we couldn't right now drop a nuclear bomb in Afghanistan. That would horrify people, and they wouldn't be able to, well, so far they couldn't get away with it. I mean, there would have to be a bunch of terrorist attacks in the United States, like at Walmart and stuff, and the U.S. government would have to say, we know that this was caused by people based in Afghanistan, and we just blow them up with a nuclear bomb, we'll end these attacks on Walmart. I mean, it had to be something like that. They couldn't just say, oh, we're taking too many casualties in terms of our infantry, and that's why we're going to drop a nuclear bomb to spare U.S. lives. I think people would that's too much. So, I mean, that's kind of what I'm saying. And if you they might have tactical nuclear weapons, if that's what you're getting at. So it's, I can imagine if we're thinking, okay, there's an anarchist society that's in Africa or the Middle East or somewhere, and they're surrounded by some nuclear powers, and I could see them having tactical nukes so that if anyone ever brought a bunch of tanks into their territory, they could just... But the thing is, I'm talking about strategic nuclear weapons, the ability to be able to launch an ICBM to go 100 kilometers plus and just blow the heck out of some foreign city and take out 100,000 people. I don't think legally they'd be able to do that, because you can't just go kill 100,000 people in the anarchist legal framework, because that's collateral damage. You can't do that. And so I'm saying legally I don't think they'd be able to, and now the question is, okay, well, does that make them a sitting duck? And I don't think so. Whereas tactically, you could have a tactical nuke, that if an enemy troops come in and you want to be able to drop a bomb that will wipe out everything within a one-mile radius, I could see that. And you might take out some of your own civilians, and then you'd have to compensate them, but that would at least be affordable, and maybe that's the cheapest way to deal with a whole bunch of enemy tanks coming in, rather than you having your own tanks, just to say, well, we've invested in a few tactical nukes, and we have $1 billion in financial assets that we can use to compensate our own people in case we unfortunately have to take some of them out, and that's the way we have, like, a porcupine defense. And so any foreign government knows if we try to take these people over, we're going to have unacceptable casualties. But if what you're asking is, would it be necessary for them to have the ability to just wipe out hundreds of thousands of other people in other countries, and that's the deterrent to make their governments not try to blackmail us or take us over, I just don't see legally how they could do that. And I don't think you can just say, well, there'd be an exception for that, because then that kind of throws everything out the window. So if you if I'm not satisfying you, you know, go ahead and push back, but that's my answer thus far. Okay, George Smith says, Rothbard said he differed from Friedman, that he, Rothbard, hated the state, whereas his impression was Friedman lacked this visceral reaction. This seems to be a serious problem to overcome. People who would agree with anarcho-capitalist arguments might still feel elated when they hear, say, their national anthem. Do you think embracing anarcho-capitalism is comparable to abandoning religion, which in this case takes the form of a deep-seated feeling of love for the state? Well, it is for some people. If you're asking, does it need to be, I don't know. Certainly, there are different personality types of people in the movement. I get the sense that, I mean, how can I put it? I don't want to name names. There are some anarcho-capitalists out there, public anarcho-capitalists, who are still acting like nothing big is going on, you know, in terms of their public persona and the stuff they blog about or whatever when they give talks. They're not talking about the U.S. having drones blowing up kids overseas. They're not talking about, oh my gosh, look at all stuff Bernanke's doing. They're talking about, you know, weird little economics problems and stuff. And they happen to be anarcho-capitalists. And so that, to me, is odd that you understand how a free society could work. You believe it would, and yet you're not using your platform right now to try to say, holy cow, we're turning into a police state. That we're taking over the global empire. The U.S. has flying robots that are blowing up civilians. What the heck? And that's what they're not. So that's weird to me. I don't understand, you know, and maybe it's because they don't want to mess up their job position. I'm not even saying this to judge them. I'm just trying to understand the different positions, whereas there are other people who aren't anarchists, like people who believe in the Constitution that are freaking out saying, we're turning into a lawless regime. How can the president have a secret list of Americans that can be killed with flying robots? Let's go back to having the Constitution. So they're not even anarchists, and they're getting more fired up about it. So if that's part of what you're getting at, George, yes, I agree with, I understand what Rothbard was talking about, that for some people, anarcho-capitalism is this interesting intellectual pastime, you know, sort of like saying, oh, well, what would happen if the Millennium Falcon fought a Star Destroyer, fought the Enterprise? Let's go through that. Or, you know, what could Batman beat Wolverine in a fight? Okay. And how would private defense forces operate against the state? Let's think of that. You know what I mean? Like, it's just this hypothetical academic curiosity and not this burning passion for, I want the world to be like this, because that will, there'll be more justice in such a world. So that is true, and I don't know what's going on with that. I don't know psychologically how to explain that, but for sure you can observe it, that some people don't get all fired up and don't consider themselves to be part of some cause. They're just more saying, oh, this is academically what I think about these things, intellectually. So if you're asking me, I don't know what you're asking. Are you saying, is the only way we're going to get to an anarcho-capitalist society to be if people are more passionate about it? Well, that certainly helps, but I'll take the intellectual, you know what I mean? Like, it certainly helps the more intellectual. Let me put you this way. This is a great personal example. Literally just last night, or maybe I even did it today, I can't remember. Either last night or today, on my Facebook profile, I posted my talk from Mises University talking about the market for security, you know, where I basically condense everything I'm doing with you guys in this course into a one-hour lecture and hit all the highlights. And I posted that on my Facebook page because probably 2,500 of my Facebook friends call themselves anarchists, if not more. But I hesitated because there are a few business clients on that list. I mean, there are people who pay me to do consulting economics work, and they're not anarchists. They're minarchists. And so they like me because I can talk about cutting spending and, you know, how do we reform Medicare and all this kind of stuff. And what I'm giving is very free market analysis, but I'm not literally saying, and I think in a perfect world there would be no state. So I did hesitate, thinking, do I really want to just get in these people's faces and make them think I'm some nut job, because maybe they're going to be less likely to hire me in the future if they're worried about them being associated with a bunch of anarchists, right? So I went ahead and did it because, first of all, I thought, well, if I'm not being public about it, then who is going to be, you know what I mean? Because I'm pretty out there already, and so I might as well not shy away from it. But also I thought, well, no, there's actually a growing number of publicly disclosed anarchists out there who are at reputable schools, like, you know, a bunch of guys at GMU, a bunch of other people all over the place, and they have tenure so they can do that. But I'm saying it helps me that Brian Kaplan is an anarcho-capitalist, and that he's at his perch at GMU spotting that stuff. So it actually gives me some cover so that I don't look like a complete nut job. That you can say, no, no, there is a respectable literature. You know, Alex Tabarrok edited a book on this. Ben Powell's edited a book on these things. Ed Stringham's been publishing stuff about blah, blah, blah. And so it almost is good if you can have this little intellectual hobby horse for some academics who it's clear they're not secretly plotting to overthrow their government in their spare time. That this is just a thing like, well, no, actually, the free market could probably work here because of blah, blah, blah. It makes it look, it diffuses it and makes it look like it's sort of an intellectual thing. So that's, I don't know if that's helping you, George, but I'm saying if your goal really is to how do we evangelize and how do we get the message out and get a bunch of people who really are burning with the desire to end injustice and to have a voluntary society, it's better to have those people than not, for sure. And if you're saying, is it better that everybody who's an anarcho-capitalist is burning with passion for it, actually it might help to have a few people in prestigious public positions who don't seem like they're doing it because they think this needs to happen tomorrow. That they're just doing it intellectually, because then that makes it seem less nut job to the people who have yet to be persuaded. Okay, let me just answer one more quick one because we're at time over time at this point. Let's see, Colin Knight says, and some of you still have pending questions, so I'll save these and answer them when I do a burst on the Moodle forum. Colin says, would an ANCAP society choose peaceful means to avoid nuclear warfare? I'm thinking that instead of nuclear armaments, we would put our resources towards surviving a nuke attack, you know, bunkers and that sort of stuff, similar to the Swiss. If an ANCAP society would likely survive a nuclear attack and have private arms to deal with an invasion, and had a peaceful foreign policy, along with the bad press a nuke aggressor would receive, wouldn't this be enough? Again, Colin, it's hard to speak in broad generalities. We'd have to get more specific about the scenario. So, yeah, in general, I think it's true that an ANCAP society would not develop nuclear weapons, and if they did, they would be tactical, not maybe if for no other reason than just the liability that. And I get into this in chaos theory. I haven't talked about it so much in our courses, in our lectures with this course. I think just to be a company in an anarcho-capitalist society that owns a bunch of nuclear warheads, you would need huge insurance policies just in case one of those things went off accidentally, right? Just like if you were going to be a nuclear power plant generating electricity, you would have to have really big insurance coverage as compared to if you use hydropower to generate electricity, because there's not a chance that the waterfall is going to get out of control and blow up everybody and give them all cancer. You might have to worry about if what you did somehow floods the city and drowns a bunch of people, but you get the idea. So if you held a stockpile of tactical nuclear weapons, and if somebody broke into your place and stole them and went off and set them off, I think you might need insurance to cover that possibility. But just like if you're a hospital, you might, and what if some crazy guy kidnaps the actual doctor and comes in and goes into surgery and he's all, you know, decked out, and so the other people don't realize it's not the real doctor for a minute, and he kills somebody. Would the family of that guy who just died on the operating table be able to sue the hospital? Probably. And so the hospital would need insurance coverage for that kind of crazy outcome. So by the same token, I think if you're a defense agency and you have tactical nuclear weapons, probably among the other things that you need in your standard insurance coverage is the possibility of what if one of our employees goes rogue, or what if somehow a criminal organization comes in and robs us and takes one of these things and uses it to go rob a bank or something. I think that company would be susceptible to lawsuits and saying you should have had better policies in place, better procedures to guard those tactical nukes so that criminal didn't get them. So I don't think it would be economical for them to own weapons that really could cause a lot of damage just because the insurance premiums would be so high. But maybe they would have really isolated tactical ones. And so we could come up with various scenarios, Colin, but I think you're right. that the outcome and the equilibrium outcome would probably not be, for sure, I don't think there would actually be a nuclear exchange. I don't think that would happen because it wouldn't be worth it to anybody. And if that sounds naive, I would just point out there's never been a nuclear exchange in the real world. The only time that anyone's ever used a nuclear bomb was when the U.S. had a monopoly. And they dropped two of them to basically show the world, don't mess with us, we're running the world for the next 50 years, step off. And then no one's ever used them again. And I think because even the people running states realize these things are dangerous, and if they get out of hand, you know, so they can, you can use them to blackmail people, and they can certainly, certainly the U.S. is able to take over countries where if those countries had nuclear weapons, the U.S. wouldn't have invaded them. But I'm saying no one has ever actually used them yet. So I don't think all of a sudden a stateless society would be a sitting duck for a bunch of people dropping nuclear bombs on them when we haven't seen that happen yet, because they would have much better defenses than stateless societies right now that are not armed. Okay, I got to stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in. But these are all great questions. I don't mean to make it sound like this is the final definitive answer and you guys are wrong if you disagree. I'm just saying if you do disagree, try to spell out something a little bit more specific so we can really think about some possible scenario, as opposed to just saying generic statements like, would an anarchist society need to have a nuclear deterrent capability? That's too vague. Like, where are they? Is it some little island somewhere? Is it Canada turns anarcho-capitalist and the U.S. is right next to them? You know, that kind of stuff.